Once we get to know who and what God really is, we then change our idea of who we really are in relationship to that entity that I call God, and even more importantly, perhaps in the present instance, we change our idea of who we really are in relationship to each other. We realize, people who have had a direct communication with the divine, that there's no separation between us and what I call God, that we are all one.
Hello, I'm Julie Kroll. You're listening to the Dr. Julie Show, All Things Connected. Each week we gather right here to make connections that break through the illusion of separation. Welcome. Your journey of conscious evolution continues right here, right now. I was a sophomore in high school and very frustrated with how immature I felt the guys my age were. After an exceptional downer of a weekend where most of my friends were focused on partying, I had a conversation with God. Walking down junior hall to vocal class, I asked, "If I'm going to marry someone someday, what kind of guy will I marry?" Immediately, I heard the reply, "Someone grounded, responsible, and hardworking, someone like Kevin Kroll." I paused for a brief second and thought, "Kevin Kroll, who's that?" I knew his brother Jeff, but I didn't know him, which was unusual in our small school. This simple yet profound conversation with God planted seeds which blossomed into my 41-year marriage. Do you have conversations with God? How does God communicate with you? If you're listening to this, I imagine you have your own way of communicating with God. Our guest today says God is communicating with all of us all of the time, even when we're not actively seeking such a conversation. Let's explore this idea and what our conversations tell us about our innate, emerging, and evolutionary capacities. What do they teach us about being co-evolutionary partners with life? I'm also wondering, what does God say about the new structures, abilities, understandings, and ways of being on the planet right now? How do we navigate during these evolutionary times of great transition? And how do we transcend to the next level of functioning? Our guest has spent a lifetime exploring all of this, so I invite you to take a few conscious breaths, bring your awareness to your heart, open your mind, and settle into your essential wholeness as I introduce my co-host and guest. My co-host, Dr. Paul J. Mills, is professor of public health and family medicine at the University of California, San Diego. He's the author of the award-winning book, Science, Being and Becoming, The Spiritual Lives of Scientists. And our guest today, Neil Donald Walsh, has written 40 books on contemporary spirituality and its practical application in everyday life, including 9 books in the Conversations with God series, 7 of which made the New York Times bestseller list. Book 1, and I have to just pause and have you really hear what I'm about to say. Book 1 remained on that list, the New York Times bestselling book, for 134 weeks. His titles have translated into 37 languages and have been read by millions of people around the world. And I'm holding God Talk in my hand, a book that both Paul and I contributed a personal story. So welcome, Neil. Welcome back to the Dr. Julie Show. I'm really happy to have you here.
Thank you, Julie. That was a very sweet introduction. And it's lovely to be here with you, but I can't go one inch further, not one second further, without asking you, because you left us all hanging here. You said you were married for 42 years, but was it to Kevin?
That's probably a really good story, isn't it? Well, my last name is Kroll, so yes, I did marry Kevin. We started dating months after that.
I was just going to say, you got to at least fill in the blank, because you realize you left us hanging. You got this conversation with God. Who are you going to marry? Somebody like Kevin Crowe, and then we're sitting here going, well, and then what happened? And you decided not to tell us. So you started dating a month later.
A couple months after that.
And you had a 42-year marriage, which means you married him when you were like 12?
I married when we were 12 and we're still married. So yeah.
Amazing.
So young.
Totally amazing.
Thank you. Thanks for asking that, Neil. I tell that story because it's a real simple one that's very concrete. And I want to talk about these conversations with God. And so many people hear different ways of connecting with the divine, different kinds of messages. We all communicate so differently at different times. A lot of times I just get that real direct hit just like that. And so I like to use that example for people because other than other real specific psychic hits that I might get, that one is really concrete. Like, I didn't even know Kevin, you know, like, who's this Kevin Kroll? Like that, it really turned something on inside of me going, what is this? Who is this? What, you know, so I like to use that. But so let's begin there, Neil, starting to talk about conversations with God and conversations about God, because this is an important dialogue for us to have on the planet right now. And you say, you teach us in this book that not only our conversations with God, but our conversations about God can literally change the world today, and we need this. So let's begin there. How can conversations about God help end the illusion of separation? And then maybe we can get into what are conversations with God?
Well, my answer to the question, Julie, is that I believe that conversations about God can awaken us to the reality, the ultimate reality, which is a multifold reality, Julie. At level one, that the fact that there even is such an entity, if you please, a higher power that some people call God, Yahweh, Jehovah, by a whole series of names, but we're talking about the same essential essence, the same essential entity. So that's level one. Then the next level is not only that there is such a creature, such an entity that I call God, but that God actually is, in fact, communicating with us, in us, as us, through us, in a thousand different ways, across 100 lifetimes, in a million different moments. So when we begin to understand that, we can use that awareness to change our lives by listening carefully to all of the incoming messages that we are receiving. But let me see if I can answer your specific question a little more directly, how it could change the world. Once we get to know who and what God really is, we then change our idea of who we really are in relationship to that entity that I call God, and even more importantly, perhaps in the present instance, we change our idea of who we really are in relationship to each other. We realize, people who have had a direct communication with the divine, that there's no separation between us and what I call God, that we are all one. And not only is there no separation between us and God, but there's no separation between us and each other. That there really is only one thing in all of the cosmos, one essential essence, if you please, an essential energy that's manifesting in countless different ways, but the same energy. And once we understand that, if we were actually to embrace that notion, and having embraced that notion, Julie, begin to interact with each other as if that were a functional reality, a practical truth that we could embrace in our daily life and cause to be part of our interactions. If people on this planet did that, of course, I hate to be so obvious and perhaps so simplistic, but if you'll pardon me for being so simplistic, everything that's negative in the way we interact with each other, wars, anger, violence, I shouldn't say anger, but violent anger, violence, verbal and physical violence, would come to an immediate end. Because if we realize, that is, if we made real, if we realize, like when you Simonize your car, you Simonize your car, if you realize who you really are, then you will start treating other people as part of you. And if we all, it goes without saying that if we all did that on the earth, the world would change virtually overnight. I'm sorry to say that it's taken us thousands of years to even contemplate the possibility that that could be true. There was a guy walking around the planet 2,000 years ago who actually said that. He said, you know, why don't you just do unto others as you would have it done unto you? And the implied message, of course, was that there are no others. There's only another version of you. And I believe he also probably said that, but it was probably one of the many statements that were left out of the writings and the narrative summaries of what he had to say. But I believe he said the same thing 2,000 years ago that we're saying right now, that there really is only one of us, that we are all part of the self-same essential essence called the divine. I could be wrong about all of that, but that's my understanding.
Thank you, Neil. From my point of view, what a powerful way to begin our conversation, because for me, in many ways, it gets to the heart of the matter. And that being when you raised that question, Julie and Neil, you spoke about how having conversations about God can begin to open up a dialogue and in particular begins to change our own understanding of ourself, of humanity's understanding of who and what we are. And that really brings me to my first question. You have a chapter earlier in your book titled, Can Anyone Talk With God, Speak With God? And that raised the question to me, how did we as human beings get to a point where we even have to ask that question? And I know you address it later in the book a bit, but I'd love to hear you speak about that now. Later in the book, you speak about messages of madness. You just referred to some of the things Jesus spoke about that were, you know, left out and so forth. But we've had such a misunderstanding of who we are, and that's hurt us.
All my awareness is, and again, I'm really speaking totally hypothetically, but what I was given to understand in my conversation with God experience is that we got to this place that you're now describing because it was God's and is, not only was, but is God's continuing and eternal desire for all of God's creations to experience themselves as creators. God wanted us to know that we are, in fact, if I could put it this way, smaller versions of itself, that we are each an individuation, if you please, of the divine. Now, if that's true, if I am an individuation and you are an individuation of the divine, that would mean that in our own way, proportionate to our size, fair enough, but that in our own way, we too are creators. But here's the problem. We can't be creators if we are clear that everything that ever was is now and ever will be, already is. That is, there's nothing to create. So the only way that we could be experiencing ourselves as creators would be for us to forget that everything has already been created. But we're not really creating in the fundamental sense of the word. We're not, you know, creating something out of thin air. We're simply remembering that it was always there to begin with and calling it forth. But there's a difference between calling forth a reality that has already existed and simply bringing it into our awareness. There's a difference between that action and the action of creating something out of the clear blue sky, creating something out of thin air. So no one is creating anything out of thin air, in my understanding, but we are appearing to do so because we have forgotten who we are, why we are here, and the fact that everything that ever was, is now, and ever will be has already been created. Or to put it in one simple sentence, even before you ask, I will have answered. Was it possible? I mean, my mind sat there for hours trying to figure out what was meant by that statement. Even before you ask, I will have answered, saith the Lord. How could that be possible? Unless, of course, it was already created. The request that we've made has already been responded to. So the action of our creating something in our life is simply a process of remembering that it was always there and then calling it forth. I'm not sure if I answered your question,
You did? Yeah, and I appreciate that. And I know many Eastern philosophies have a similar, let's say, approach and understanding that, at least historically, I was raised Catholic, and the West has a very different understanding about God and our relationship to God. And
boy, do we ever.
Yeah, our own potential. So I'm so pleased that you spent a good portion of the book just writing about how do we change the world's mind about God, our own idea about God. And I know your Conversations with God Foundation, that's one of the three primary aims. Let's wake up to this, the reality of God and who and what we are.
And for a very good reason, Paul. Let's wake up to the reality for a very good reason. Not because it's an interesting or a nice thing to do, but because it allows us to complete our agenda as individuals and as a species. If I'm correct about this, our agenda is evolution, the evolution of each of us individually, and our evolution as a civilization. And that's why I say the things that I say, because if we can reach critical mass with regard to the number of people who understand what I'm suggesting here, suddenly we will have moved to the next level in our evolution, individually and as a species.
Neil, that's exactly, I got excited here when you went right there. I was like, oh yes, let's go there, because if you're talking about everything has already been created and we're in this process of remembering and we're waking, we're talking about the evolution of consciousness in big ways on the planet right now and this great awakening that's before us. So let's say this is a part of the entire plan, and we're all doing our part as we're waking to that. Part of Paul and I doing this series, Main Street Mystic series, is to help normalize this non-ordinary consciousness and really talk about transpersonal, metaphysical, and mystical experiences, to talk about God, like you talk about in the book, that this is an essential, important time. So I'm wondering also, it's like this awakening period is also helping us to develop new capacities that perhaps have been dormant in the forgetting phase or have been dormant in the other evolutionary phase as we begin to really expand in consciousness on the planet. So I'm wondering what your wisdom can share with us in this oneness that we are, as we're looking at talking to God, is this talking to and listening to still is in separation. And we're really working on what are these capacities to really ground that beingness of oneness. I'm wondering what you're noticing or what might be the more grounded unitive state for us and for humanity as a whole as we begin this phase of awakening with, like you were talking about, even just getting to that critical mass, that one level that's really going to wake humanity. How do we do this? How do we turn this capacity on more full time and be in this unitive state rather than having moments here and there? I know you've been working on that.
With your permission and with your kindness, Julie, I'm going to go back to a word you used at the beginning of your question. You said something about your wisdom, referring to me. I need to make it very, very clear to everybody who's hearing my words right now that this has nothing to do with my wisdom. I have no wisdom. That is, I have no greater wisdom than anybody else on the planet. And I can't allow anyone to think that I do have more wisdom than anybody else. Now, if you had said in the beginning of your question, share with me the wisdom you received in your conversations with God, I could be comfortable with that, because I do believe that all of us are receiving enormous wisdom from that source of divine clarity. But if we agree that it's not Neil's wisdom we're talking about here, but what I was told in conversations with God, then that ground of being you're talking about that allows us to live into that unitive state more of the time, if not all the time. That ground of being begins with our understanding and our acceptance, our embracing of the notion that, oh, there's more going on here than meets the eye. Life is not simply what it appears to be. It's not a simple case of you're born, you live, you die, and that's the beginning and the end of it. There's more going on here than meets the eye. And I am more than I at one time thought I was. And we are more than most of us think that we are. So here is how I think we can find that ground of being that could allow us to step into that unitive state more of the time. And I love the phrase you use, by the way, because I've never quite used that phrase, the unitive state, but I love the way you're saying that. The key for me is a simple four-word formula that I invite people to write on their bathroom mirror. You get a little magic marker or a black felt tip pen and write the following questions, on your bathroom mirror in the top right-hand corner of your bathroom mirror. Question number one, who am I? Question number two, where am I? Question number three, why am I where I am? Question number four, what do I intend to do about that? These are what I have come to call the four magic questions of life that God invited me to ask myself every single day of my life, and more than once a day if it serves me. So whenever I look into the mirror in my bathroom, I see those four questions. Who am I? Where am I? Why am I where I am? And what do I intend to do about that? May I offer you my humble answers, which are not, I don't want to suggest that they're the answers for everybody, but the answers that I have found that resonate as the truth for me. Who am I? I am not this. This is not who I am. This is a body. But this is not who I am. If I think this is who I am, I'm going to have an entirely different response to the world than I would if I'm clear this is just a piece of equipment. It's a tool that who I am is using, but it's not who I am. Therefore, it's, if you please, disposable. That is, I don't have to spend my days and nights worrying about losing this. I'm not my body, and I'm not my mind. So I don't even have to worry, spend my days and nights worrying about losing my mind. In fact, in order for me to really understand who I am, I need to be, in a literal sense, actually out of my mind. And I've had more than one person, by the way, say to me in the past 30 years, what are you, out of your mind? And I've had to say to them, actually, yes, I'm out of my mind. I have a wonderful mind, but it's also a tool. It's a piece of equipment. Magnificent tools. This body of mind is a magnificent tool. And my mind is a brilliant, magnificent tool used by who I really am. And who I really am, in my experience, is a spiritual entity, being a body and a mind, but on a journey that has nothing to do specifically with the outcomes of my body or my mind. I mean, my soul doesn't care how much money I earned in my lifetime, how much success, quote unquote, I've had. My human standards are hardly any of the things that my body and my mind are concerned with and focused on. When I'm clear about that, Julie, when I'm clear that my soul couldn't care less about hardly any of that, it changes the way I encounter and respond to how life is coming at me. I don't experience life at all in the same way. I see things differently, experience things differently, respond to things differently, and react in a way that allows me to not react anymore. To act as if I did as I did earlier in my life. I don't react. I create. You know what's interesting? The word reaction and the word creation are the same word. Only the C and the R have gotten confused as to where they're supposed to go. Reaction, creation. Only the C and the R have to be changed. When the C and the R change places, then we see who we really are.
I love that.
So when I've come to clarity about who I am a spiritual entity having a physical experience. Nothing new about that statement. We've been told that by 1,000 people across, as I said, 1,000,000 moments in our lifetime. But to make it real for me, then I've answered question number one. Who am I? Oh, I see. I'm a spiritual entity. Question number two, where am I? I'm in the realm of the physical, as opposed to the realm of the spiritual or the realm of pure being. I'm in the realm of the physical, which is one of three realms in the kingdom of God, in my observation and in my understanding. There is the realm of the spiritual, the realm of the physical, and as I mentioned, the realm of pure being at the top of the pyramid. And anyway, I think we go from, I have this notion, I was told directly that we move in a cycle from the realm of pure being to the realm of the spiritual, to the realm of the physical, and continuing on that journey joyfully, endlessly continuing on that joyful experience of expressing our true identity, our true nature of who we really are. So that's where I am. I am in the realm of the physical. Question number three, why am I where I am? Why would my soul, if I truly am a spiritual being, why would it come into this crazy place that we call the realm of the physical? Why would I come here? Because in the realm of the spiritual, I encounter the miracle of a contextual field. And what I mean by contextual field, I mean to say that here in the realm of the physical, there is this and there is that. There is up and there is down. There is left and there is right. There is who I am and who I am not. That is, in this realm, we encounter the law of opposites. And the law of opposites allows us to experience, to express who we are. In the absence of who we are not, who we are is not experienceable. You can know who you are, but you can't experience it. The example that I have been given in conversations with God with regard to that is, Neil, pretend that you think that you're the light. I'll say, okay, fair enough, I'm the light. But now, it's one thing to know yourself as the light, but it's something else entirely different to experience and to express yourself as the light. But you can't experience and express yourself as being the light unless there is what? The darkness. Because in the absence of the darkness, if all there is the light, you can know that you are the light, but you're like a candle in the sun. You're one of a billion, kajillion, gazillion other sources of light, and you can know that. But if you want to express yourself as the light, you will literally beg for just a smidgen of darkness, that you might go into that darkness and experience yourself as the light. Every master who's walked this planet has understood what I've just said, deeply and intuitively and functionally. Every master has come to a functional understanding of what I've just said. Mm-hmm. Therefore, they would say to you, raise not your fist to heaven and curse the darkness not, but be a light unto the darkness, that you might know who you really are. Mm-hmm. And that all those whose lives you touch might know who they really are as well. It's really quite simple, but Horatio didn't understand it. He was trying to figure out, what are you talking about? Which is why Hamlet had to say to Horatio, there are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy. Or to put it in simple language, there's more going on here than meets the eye. So the question becomes really, as Bill put it more simply, to be or not to be. That is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to rise up against a sea of troubles and by opposing to end them, to die, to sleep perchance to dream, aye, there's the rub. In that sleep of death, what dreams may come. When we are clear what dreams come in the sleep of death that does not exist, when we understand that death does not even exist, we simply change addresses. It's a change of address. We go to the Universal Post Office and file a change of address form. And we continue to exist forever and ever. When we understand that, it changes the way we interact with every event in life. At least it did for me. I can't speak for anybody else. And I could be wrong about everything I've just said.
And Neil, your fourth question is,
What do you intend to do about that?
Yeah. What do you intend to do about that?
And I see, I answer that question every moment in the living of my life. Mm-hmm. So the movement of myself through the day-to-day moments of life is my answer to the question, what do you intend to do about that? Who am I? Where am I? Why am I where I am? And what do I intend to do about that? Watch me. Watch me. And I'll show you. I'll show you what I intend to do about that. And again, I want to make it very clear. It's not that I think that I'm right about that, but yeah.
There is an embodiment there then of that, like I was talking, the unitive state, that when you reorient to those questions, even common interactions, really what I noticed when you were talking was, it's like it embraces the physical, it embraces our humanness, and yet it allows this unitive state to kind of substantiate and stabilize. So we can have those experiences with light and dark, with a higher knowing that there is only that, there is only one. And yet here we be in the contextual playing and having fun and enjoying even the smallest little details of that embodiment. So I really appreciate how you brought that in. Thank you for those questions.
Yeah, and Julie, you mentioned our humanness a moment ago. And Neil, you said the agenda for human beings, humanity, is evolution. And you also mentioned that really everything's already created. So who is the future human? Where are we headed? It would be nice to hear that, because that'd be very inspiring for those, managing and trying to learn during this time of change and possibilities. So how do you understand who is the future human? What do we look like? What are we doing?
I think we look like those people who have walked among us, who we have already declared to be masters. Mm-hmm. And that, and there's more than one of them, with respect to all of those who believe there's only one. But I, even the one who many believe is the only one, said to those who were aghast with surprise at what he was able to do, he looked at them and he said, "Why are you so amazed? These things and more shall you do also." Mm-hmm. So I think that he was predicting that we would all step into what he was already demonstrating. He was just ahead of his time. But he wasn't different from any of us. He was simply ahead of his time. So I think we will all look like those people, both men and women, who we have declared to be masters who have walked on this planet. And we will be eternally loving. Mm-hmm. We will be never forgive anyone. I should say that. I should make that real clear. We will never forgive anyone for anything. So we will be utterly unforgiving. And we will be, you're supposed to ask me now.
I was about to, but I thought you might say something more. Okay, please clarify that, although I have a sense of it. It's because there's nothing ever taken in offense, because that state, the unitive divine state, love is unconditional and ongoing.
Exactly. So God will never forgive us for anything, because it's impossible to anger, frustrate, annoy, injure, damage, or hurt God in any way. Because God is everything that it could possibly be. And there's nothing that God wants, needs, or requires from anyone or anything. And when we begin to embrace our true identity, the same becomes true of us. We realize that no one can really hurt, injure, damage us in any way, any more than a 13-month-old child could hurt us. You know, or if you're a little 4 or 6-year-old granddaughter, you know, at the kitchen table, is so excited because she's celebrating her 7th birthday. And she reaches for the chocolate cake. "Oh, my favorite cake. Mommy made my favorite cake." And spills the milk all over the table. And she's aghast because the table is now a mess. And Grandpa says, "It's okay, sweetheart. Grandpa forgives you." Of course not. No grandpa would ever say anything close to that, because grandpa understands how such a thing could happen. And grandpa understands that forgiveness is not part of the equation. In fact, what grandpa says to the child, not only does he not say, "I forgive you," what he actually says is he comforts the child mm-hmm. in the moment of her despair. And so we don't forgive anyone, because we understand how a person with a different state of consciousness from our own could have done or said what they've done or said. And our compassion gives us the place to understand how they could have behaved in that way. So write this on your bathroom mirror as well. Understanding replaces forgiveness in the mind of the master.
Mm. I'm hearing the words from Grandpa, "Let's just clean that up and have a bigger piece of cake." You know, like,
yeah,
let's go.
And of course, he says, "I hate to be so trite," but he says, "There's no use crying over spilled milk."
Yeah. Something's moving in the field here. So I really would love to hear how you might address this, because you talk about in the book that we've misunderstood God, and that's even through the conversations of God. Some of the things I love is the grandest vision of the da da da, the grandest version of the greatest vision of the. But in God Talk, you talk about us being made in the likeness of God. I want to say it how it, in the image of God. And we hear that a lot from religions. We're made in the image and likeness of God. But there's a deeper understanding of that. If we hear that in separation, we think, oh, we're created like God, a man, and a da, da, da. But there's something really intrinsic about this from a cellular being. I think we can feel it. Our heart resonates with it, that it's more than being created like something when we really understand that we are that. Can you speak to that, Neil? The difference between seeing that, understanding it in separation, and really embodying that likeness that we are, that oneness of.
I'm not sure that I can speak to it more eloquently than you just did. Mm-hmm. You just said it perfectly. We in fact are that. And it's not like we are similar to that or like that. We in fact are that, just exactly as you said. You put it perfectly. I can't improve on what you just said.
Thank you, Neil. So when we embody that,
the question becomes, how do we embody that? See, every moment of our life, we get to ask ourselves, what would God do now? What would God say now? What would God feel now? And what I invite people to do in the book that I wrote called The God Solution is to meld your feeling in any moment with what you imagine God would feel like in that same moment. To meld the two together so the two become one. So that you feel as you understand God would feel, confronted with the exact same circumstance that you're now being confronted with, whatever it might be, positive or what you would call in the old days a negative. And so I think that's the answer in terms of the action we can take. Every moment of our life provides us with an invitation. It's an opportunity. It's a golden invitation. We open up the envelope, you're invited to, and then we get to be the answer to the question. If we really were divine, what would we be thinking, saying, and doing right now? When I say this in front of an audience, someone inevitably says, oh, Neil, 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 do you really think it's possible for human beings to do that? I mean, come on, aren't you raising the bar kind of high for us to try to imagine what God would be thinking, saying, and doing right now? But in fact, it's what every master has done. It's what every human being who we have called a spiritual master has done. They've done precisely that. They even raised themselves from the dead.
Yeah.
Do you believe it really happened? Yeah, I believe it really happened. Yeah, I believe it really happened.
Yeah, Neil, let's just pause there for a minute, because I think that's what a lot of our listeners will be listening for carefully, is this idea of those capacities that, and Paul just asked that too. It's like, as we really step into the expression of our divinity, I think a lot of people are waiting for that magical thing that's going to happen, or we're going to grow wings, or we're going to be an angel, or we're going to be light beings, or we're going to ascend to a fifth, and then, oh, we're going to, like, a lot of people are holding it. But literally, with that embodied consciousness, as we're evolving, we heal and we can perform miracles in every day. And some might say they're ordinary miracles, but we're watching as these innate capacities are turning on. I'm wondering if you know, have a sense of what those capacities, as we look at some of these models, these masters, Jesus for one, that transcended or ascended and healed and performed miracles, and the, you know, the wine and the loaves of bread and the, you know, like, I'm wondering what you might say to our listeners who are listening, saying, what are those innate capacities as our consciousness expands and we understand our divinity?
You used a phrase a minute ago that caught my ear again. You keep on doing it. You said, but those are ordinary miracles. Wait a minute. What a juxtaposition. Ordinary miracles? It's either a miracle or it's not. Ordinary miracles? No. What makes a miracle is that it's extraordinary. Even the smallest thing is not an ordinary miracle. to have someone slight you or fail to invite you to the big party that everyone else that you know has been invited to, or whatever else it might be. It's not an ordinary miracle for you to decide that you're okay about that, that you're at peace with regard to that, and that you will never, ever subtract one iota, not one moment of love from that person's experience of you because they did or said that. That's not an ordinary miracle. That's the miracle of divinity flowing in you, through you, as you. And if you do that throughout the moments of your life, be careful, because you'll find not only your life changing, but you changing. That is, you will experience your life in a softer, gentler, kinder, sweeter, more compassionate, more understanding, more joyful, more eternally joyful way than you might have ever done before. And I would not call that an ordinary miracle. But an ordinary miracle is saying to a person who's done the unforgivable, I love you. And nothing you can do or be or say can stop me from loving you. Because I love you for who I see you as being. I see you, you can't fool me. I see who you really are. Which is why I love that movie Avatar. Wonderful movie. It's a great love story. But it's the only love story Hollywood ever made where the words between the two people, I love you, are never spoken. They hug, they kiss, they embrace. They do all things that lovers do, but they never say to each other in that film anywhere, I love you. You know what they say? I see you. I see you. When we can look at the other person, even in the moment of their transgression, if you please, and say, I see you. You can't fool me. I know who you really are, and I love who you really are. You don't have to prove yourself to me, now or ever, because I want, need, require, demand, and hope for nothing in return from you for loving you. I'm not loving you to see what I can get from you. I'm loving you if I never got anything from you. Now we understand what true love really is, what pure love really is. I could be wrong.
I'm finding myself wondering why you often end what you happen to speak about at that moment with, it might be true, I might be wrong, it might not be.
Because I don't want people to think that I'm self-righteous in my understanding. I don't want anyone to think, oh, he thinks he's got all the answers. You know what? I could be wrong. I mean, I literally could be wrong.
Yeah.
I don't think that I am. I've lived my life this way in the past 30 years of my life. I've been dramatically different than the first 50. Imagine throwing a half century away, in a sense, before I got to understand what's really going on here, who I am and why I'm here and what's going on. But at least I got 30 good years out of it.
Yeah. So I have a question for you, and it's along the lines of what you were just speaking about, the importance when a human being begins to wake up to have that capacity, which I imagine goes in line with the awakening, say, to the reality of God and our relationship with God. And the book, you speak about the importance of waking up and correcting our own minds about God. And you share a couple you called, quote, messages of madness. These are things that we've all been imprinted with to some degree that have kept us away from having that living understanding and really operating as a more fully awakened human being. Can you share maybe one or two of messages of madness for the purpose of So people can have an awareness about it for themselves, those who carry that around, and then to be able to have some freedom from that message.
You can't fight City Hall. You can't fight City Hall. That was a message of madness.
Yeah.
So one of the many messages of madness that I heard in my lifetime. So you know, you could read the list out of the book. You pick out a few, because you know I don't have them all memorized. You know what? Frankly, I've just decided to eliminate them from my mind.
Many people carry around this sense of unworthiness, which to me is foundationally very crippling for the person, the soul's ability to take that step, whether it's the step to start speaking about God or speaking with God. There's that sense of unworthiness. Okay.
Yeah, or the message of madness that I got when I was a child, son, you're to be seen and not heard. I'm sorry, excuse me? I mean, who said that? So, you know, that we've been giving these messages of madness all of our life. And I when I finally realized that I was being misled, I simply dropped them from my vocabulary and even from my memory. I refused to hold them in my memory anymore. Mm-hmm. You would have to actually remind me of what that list was that I put in the book, because I don't remember it.
Good.
I love that idea. I know with memory, I've been talking a lot lately about being so fully in the present moment that there is no past or future when you're here. And then there's no memory. Like there's nothing there. Like it's difficult. Neil, our hour is coming quickly to a close. We have a few more minutes, and I want to give you an opportunity to share anything of inspiration to our listeners that we might not have been able to cover yet. I'm thinking in terms of really normalizing this unitive state and the work that you're doing now, so that it's not this transient thing, but we really all come into this wake up together. What might you share of inspiration to our listeners?
Well, I don't know that it would inspire anybody, so I don't want to set myself up for complete failure. So it may or may not inspire anybody, but it did inspire me. I can go that far. It's when I ask God, can't you just explain to me in a simple sentence or two, you know, how the whole game goes down here on this planet? And God said, sure. Neil, sweetheart, your life has nothing to do with you. Your life is not about you. It's about everyone whose life you touch and the way in which you touch it. And when you understand that, you'll be able to grasp a much larger truth, which is that in the largest sense, your life is about you for a very remarkable reason. There's only one of us in the room. There's nobody else here. Since I got that message, I've tried to live my life in a way that allows me to demonstrate that life isn't about me. It's about everyone whose life I touch and the way in which I touch it. And not that I've been a, you know, incredible success with that, and that I'm walking on water, or you moving through life as this sainted person, because anyone who knows me would tell you that I don't do that. But I think that people who've known me for a while would say, he's doing better. He's a different person than he was 30 years ago when I first met him. So he found something clearly that's working for him, which is going to allow me to put four words on my gravestone. I've asked my family, all those who know me, please make sure these four words are on my headstone. Now that was fun.
Beautiful. Beautiful. And going back just another minute prior to the gravestone, that was another message for the mirror. I loved that message that there's only one of us in the room. And I'm going to encourage our listeners to put that on the mirror. And before I close, I just want to say thank you, Neil, for joining us. It was I was inspired. Absolutely. And I love the wisdom that's received through the vessel called Neil Donald Walsh. Thank you so much for joining us in this conversation today. I thought it was exquisite. How about you, Paul?
I'm right there with you, Julie. Thank you, Neil.
It's been wonderful to be here with you. Thanks for the invitation and for the opportunity. You're both very gentle and very kind with me. And I appreciate that very, very much. Thank you both.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Listeners, I want to leave you with a few final words from Neil in his book, God Talk. We are being invited by life. And in this moment, by this book and this conversation that you're listening to right now, to start conversations about God in polite company. We are being asked to end the illusion of separation and to embrace and share the truth that we are all one, and that each of us is made in the image and likeness of God. By deciding to actually talk about God more often, more openly, and with more people, you can play a role in bringing an awareness of the true nature of divinity to others. I'm Julie Kroll. You've been listening to the Dr. Julie Show, All Things Connected. This is the Main Street Mystic Series with co-host Paul J. Mills. Remember, together, we are creating connections for the good of the whole. Until next time, we're sending you a world of love. Bye for now. If you enjoyed the show, go to your favorite podcast platform. Remember to subscribe, rate, and leave us a review. Also, please consider supporting the Dr. Julie Show at patreon.com/allthingsconnected. When we each give a little, we all get a little more. You can stay in touch with me at juliekrollemail.com. Thanks for listening.